Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everyone. Okay, tonight, after having lectured on the Majjhima Nikaya now for 4 years, we come to the very first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, sutta number one. This is called the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, the discourse. Here is translated the title, The Root of All Things. And it's actually a very difficult sutta. So when I advise people on how to read the Majjhima Nikaya, I always say, skip over the first discourse. Don't read it at the beginning. Only read the first discourse after you've read pretty much all the other suttas. Then come back and read the first discourse. Because many, many years ago, when I first started to read the suttas, when I picked up the Majjhima Nikaya, this was before I had read much Buddhism at all, I thought this must be an important collection to read. Then I picked up the first sutta, and I couldn't make head or tail out of it. It was just completely bewildering. But then, eventually, I wound up translating the sutta, its commentary, and sub-commentary. And I think that the monks who compiled the Pali Canon put the Mula Pariyaya Sutta in the first place, the first position, in order to emphasize its importance. But I don't think that they did it to deter readers in those days. The texts were not read, but they were learned by memory. But they put it there in order to emphasize its importance, recognizing that when one learns the text by memory, one generally is not expected to understand them at the beginning. One just memorizes the text. And then after one has memorized many texts, then one begins to get explanations of them. Okay, so let us turn to the sutta itself. Okay, so this sutta was spoken by the Buddha when he was living in a place called Ukkata, in a particular grove, staying at the foot of a royal sala tree. Sala tree, it's a very big type of tree. And it was also between two sala trees that the Buddha passed away. Okay, so the Buddha begins by addressing the monks. He says, Bhikkhus, and then they reply, Venerable Sir. And then the Buddha says, Bhikkhus, I shall teach you, in Pali it's Sabba Dhamma Mula Pariyayam, which is what is translated here, a discourse on the root of all things. So just that very subject emphasizes its importance. I'll write that expression down in Pali. Yeah, the commentary to the sutta explains that what is meant here by all things are all the phenomena that are included in what we call individual existence, in our individuality, or in the technical word in Pali is sakkaya, which is what sometimes I translate identity, individual identity. And this word sakkaya, this means the collection of the five aggregates. So what the Buddha is going to teach in this discourse is the root, which means the root cause of all the phenomena that are included in this collection of the five aggregates that makes up our individual identity. He's going to show how our individual identity comes into being. And as the discourse unfolds, we will see that the root of all things turns out to be a particular act or process which is called conceiving. Here the Pali word, the key Pali word is manyana, which I'll elaborate on later. I'll write it later and then elaborate it on it later. And what's of further interest in this sutta is that the Buddha, as the sutta unfolds, is going to develop what we call a typology, a classification of people in terms of four basic classes, four categories. One is the ordinary person, or what is called the uninstructed worldling, the untaught ordinary person. The second will be the disciple in higher training. The third will be the arahant, the one who has completed the training. And then the fourth will be the Buddha himself, called here the Tathagata. And using this process of conceiving as the basis, the text will explicate the differences between these four types of persons. And so the Buddha begins with what is called the asuttava puttucina, which means the uninstructed worldling or the untaught ordinary person. Okay, and this is described as a person who has no regard for the Aryans, for the noble ones, and who is unskilled and untrained, undisciplined in the teaching, the Dhamma of the noble ones, who has no regard for the true persons, the sapurisa, the superior persons, the saintly persons, and who is unskilled, that's without any knowledge, and undisciplined, without any training, without any experience, practical experience in their teaching. Okay, that much is a standard way of describing the uninstructed worldly person. okay, now this person is said to perceive earth as earth. Here, earth is used just as an example. We'll see that each section is going to be elaborated in terms of 24 possible objects of experience. And so the first four will be the four primary elements, earth, water, fire, and air. And the first of the four elements is the earth element. And so it's said that the untaught or uninstructed worldly person perceives earth as earth. Okay, now, when it's said that he perceives earth as earth, if we just take this superficially, it gives the impression that he has an accurate perception of the earth. But in fact, this is not what's intended. The commentary is quite helpful here. Or actually, it's in this case, it's the Tika, the sub-commentary. Yeah, what the sub-commentary says is that he perceives it through a distorted perception. A perception that is rooted in unwise reflection. And this distorted perception already introduces a slight distortion of the object. So we can suppose that before this distorted perception takes place, initially there's a very simple, we might call this a primitive act of perception, which merely registers the object in a faint and indistinct way. Then following that very, that simple, indistinct, primitive act of perception, then there will come, through unwise reflection, there will come this distorted perception, which introduces some distortion of the object. And this distortion of the object, in Pali, this is called sanya vipalasa. Literally, it means an inversion of perception. It's a perception that turns the object upside down. A perception that grasps the object in a way contrary to its real nature. In some places in the suttas, the Buddha speaks about four kinds of vipalasas, four kinds of distortions, four kinds of distortions of perception. There's the perceiving of what is really impermanent, perceiving it to be permanent, stable and lasting. There is perceiving what is really unpleasurable or dukkha, perceiving it to be pleasant and agreeable. Then there is perceiving what is without a self, perceiving it to have a self. And then there is perceiving what is unattractive or not beautiful, perceiving it to be lovely and beautiful. Okay, so these distortions of perception occur because there's been some, even a very slight degree of unwise attention to the object. And that is what is taking place when the ordinary person, the uninstructed ordinary person here, perceives earth as earth. This sub-commentary says, when he perceives it, thinking it is earth, he perceives it as in some way endowed with a self, or as permanent, as pleasurable, or as beautiful, even though it is really without a self, impermanent, bound up with suffering, or not beautiful. Okay, then the next sentence says, having perceived earth as earth, pattaving pattavito sanyatva, I really would have preferred to translate it without putting any words in brackets, but just to translate it exactly according to the words of the text. Having perceived earth as earth, he conceives earth. He conceives in earth. He conceives from earth. He conceives earth as mine. He conceives earth to be mine. He delights in earth. Now it is at this point, based upon perception is sanya, that the next step in the process of cognition takes place, and that is what is called conceiving, or in Pali the word is manyana, where the verb form is manyati. Okay, what is it that we call manyana, conceiving? The word manyana comes from the root man, which means to think. But manyana is not just ordinary thinking. Ordinary thinking can be accurate or can be inaccurate. But what's meant by manyana, conceiving, is distortional thinking. That is, I'd explained it in the introduction to this book, it's thinking that ascribes to the object properties or relations that are grounded not in the thing itself, but in the constructive activity of the subjective imagination. Manyana is the tendency of thought to misconstrue its object or to misinterpret its object. Manyana builds upon the distortion in perception, and it apprehends or interprets the object in a way contrary to its actual nature. We might also explain manyana as imagination, not the good creative imagination, but it's deluded imagination about the object. I also saw one translator translated it as hallucinations, having hallucinations about the object. But the object is really there. It's not imagining an object that isn't there. And there's another word that comes in the Buddha suttas. I think I've mentioned it in some earlier classes. The word is papancha. Papancha is sometimes translated conceptual proliferation or conceptual elaboration. Basically, manyana and papancha are pretty much the same thing. Papancha is that process by which the mind elaborates upon the objects of perception and builds up its own interpretations of the objects. But these interpretations are deluded interpretations. They're ideas that about the object which come not from the real nature of the object, but from our own subjective proclivities, tendencies, the tendencies that stem from the mental defilements. And then there are three mental defilements that are especially responsible for this conceiving or mental conceptual elaboration. These three mental defilements are craving, conceit, and wrong views. Craving gives rise to the deluded notion of mine. What is mine? Or it gives rise to the idea of things as being attractive to me so that I want to get things and make them mine. So that things acquire the significance for me of being potential possessions, potential objects of enjoyment and possession. That significance is a projection which arises out of craving. And then when we start thinking about things in terms of that revolve around this idea of mine or what might be mine, what I would like to be mine, that is manyana, conceiving, deluded, distorted thinking. Okay, the second spring of manyana, spring of conceiving, spring of conceptual elaboration, is conceit, in Pali, mana. Conceit is the act by which we compare ourselves with others and think, I'm better, I'm equal, I'm worse. And all of these comparative ideas all revolve around the fundamental conceit which according to the Buddha's teaching is called asmimana, which means the conceit I am. That is, even before the comparisons take place, even this very idea that there is some I is a conceit, a delusion, an imagining. And because this idea, I am, arises, then we start looking out at others and measuring this I against other selves or other people. How am I compare with the others? Or how are my things compared to those of the other things? My house, is it bigger, more beautiful than their house? My car, newer, shinier, more beautiful than their car? My begging bowl, is it brighter, shinier than his begging bowl? Okay, so then all the thinking in terms of this conceit, I am, and these comparative thoughts, those are conceivings or papunchas, conceptual elaborations revolving around the notion, I am. Conceivings, elaborations rooted in conceit. And then what also happens is that this idea I am arises. It is we call it the most fundamental conceit, consideration, deluded consideration, I am. And we're constantly thinking, I am. And then we stop to reflect, what is this I am? This is, happens to the reflective type of person. And when we start examining this I, it becomes a puzzle, a problem. We have to figure out, what is this I? We're always thinking, I am this. We're always thinking in terms of, I did this, I did that. This is my name. I live here. And we use the word I so many times every day. But when we stop and ask, what is this I, it becomes a mystery, a puzzle, a problem. And then one starts reflecting on, what is this I? And one starts trying to figure out the identity of the I and to fill in some kind of, to give it some kind of substance. And that leads to the conception, I am this. Or I am that, which means that one is now starting to formulate a view of one's identity, to formulate a view of self, oneself. And so in this way, now the third spring of conceiving is now becoming active. This is called the spring of views. One starts thinking in terms of, what is this I? What is this self? It seems to be the most obvious, the closest thing in the world. But what is it? It's so mysterious. you have libraries filled with books by philosophers from the most ancient times arguing with each other about this simplest question. One says, oh, the self is something which is non-material, purely spiritual, pure consciousness, cannot be reduced to matter, substance, but it is that which is pure awareness. Right next to his book in the library, another thick volume, 600 pages, refutation, nonsense, no immaterial self, can't see it, can't touch it, can't pound it, it doesn't exist. The self is just this body made of so many elements. That is what I am. Just chemicals coming together, genes, molecules, processes of molecules. That is the self. Even consciousness, just a product of all of these molecules working together. That's what it is. Okay, so all these different views. Okay, so now the text mentions different ways in which the ordinary person might conceive any object of experience. And it mentions these ways, or it describes these ways in terms of, it uses different cases, grammatical cases. So he might conceive earth, he might conceive in earth, he might conceive from earth, he might conceive earth to be mine. The phrases themselves, if we just look at them, it's rather puzzling and mysterious. But the commentary tries to fill in and give some detailed explanations. I'll try to take some examples from the commentary. Okay, in the case of he conceives earth, okay, there are four possibilities here. One might conceive I am earth. That is, one holds I am the earth element. Or one might hold the second possibility, the earth is mine. Something in the earth element is mine. Third possibility is another person or something external is earth. And the fourth is, earth belongs to another person. Okay, so these are four misconceptions. The view, the conceiving, I am earth, this can be the conceiving of the view, I am the earth. Maybe a materialist takes the view, the self is just the earth element. Or somebody arouses conceit, maybe somebody who has a very handsome face, and then he identifies with the earth element of the body, and then he builds up a conceit, I am based on that handsome face. So that is conceit working based on the earth element. Well, somebody, in the second case, earth is mine. When one identifies with the body, takes the body to be mine. Maybe one holds that there is a self outside the body, separate from the body, but the body belongs to the self. Then one is holding the view that the body belongs to the self. That's the conceiving of a view. Or one just has a strong attachment to the body. That is the conceiving of craving. Then the third alternative, taking another person to be the earth element. In this case, one thinks it might be the case of a conceiving through views, that is, one identifies the body with the self, and one thinks the other person is just the body, the physical body, so the other person is the earth element. Or one might maybe see the other person might be very handsome and beautiful, and so one becomes envious of the other person because of their beautiful body. In this case, there is a conceiving of conceit involved here. But this is a conceit, inferiority conceit with reference to oneself. One thinks, I'm inferior, that person is so much more beautiful than I am. And so one is identifying the earth element of the other person as what they are. And because of that, one feels miserable in regard to one's own form. And so there is a kind of conceit based on the earth element of the other person. Okay, and then one has a craving in regard to the other person's body. The other person might be attractive, one wants their body. That will be a craving, taking the earth of the other person belongs to me. Or if it's a material object that one wants to get, made of the four elements, one wants that object belongs to me, the earth belongs to me. Or it could be property, physical property. That property is mine. That earth is mine. So that's conceiving through craving. One could work out many different possibilities for applying the three types of conceiving to these different alternatives. Okay, then he conceives in earth. This applies most, I think the clearest example of this comes with the conceiving in terms of views, where one conceives that there's some kind of self or soul that exists within the body. And so one conceives that there's a spiritual self or soul, and that exists within the material body. And so the body made of the four elements, including the earth element, is the receptacle, and the spirit or soul, which is I, my true self, exists in the body. In this way, one conceives in the earth. And one could also build up craving for the continued immortality of that self which is imagined to exist in the earth element. So in this way there's craving for what is in the earth element. Or if one imagines that this self is vast, great, then one could build up conceit based upon it. Okay, then the third possibility is one conceives from earth. Well, this could also be understood as one conceives apart from or separate from earth. In this case, one might conceive, for example, the self to be something which arises out or emerges from the earth element. Or one might have the view that, a very clear conceptual view, the earth element is one thing, the self is something distinct from it. The earth element is material, the self is spiritual. There can be no identity between the earth element and the self. So there are a variety of ways in which one can understand this statement. One conceives from the earth, either the self originating from the earth, or the self as something separate and distinct from the earth. Then the fourth possibility given here, this shows most clearly, most distinctly, the craving rooted in the conceiving rooted in craving. One conceives earth to be mine. This is where that craving takes its most explicit form, where one claims possession of the object. That is mine. That belongs to me. And then the last statement mentioned in the series also shows the activity of craving. It said, he delights in earth. Pattaving abhinandati. And this is very significant when it says he delights in earth, because for one who knows the suttas, one will know in the explanation of the second noble truth, when the Buddha is explaining the nature of craving, he says that craving is tatra tatra abhinandani. Craving is that which delights in this and that, or craving is what delights here and there. And the implication is that it is this craving, insofar as one goes on delighting in this and that, that maintains the continuity of existence, that leads to renewed existence. Because as long as one goes on seeking delight, seeking pleasure, seeking enjoyment, the round of existence, the round of rebirths, keeps on moving, keeps on turning. And so that is why this delighting is brought in as the culmination of this series of conceivings. So we could say that this delight, delighting here and there, is actually, will turn out to be the most fundamental root of all. Of all of these conceivings, it's this delighting that is the basic root. Then the Buddha raises the question, why is this the case? Why is it that the ordinary person, the unenlightened, uninstructed person, conceives things in this way, in this deluded way? And why he goes on delighting in this way? Then the Buddha gives the answer, because he has not fully understood it. To fully understand something means to understand it so thoroughly that one overcomes all of one's delusions about it. That one understands it completely in terms of the three characteristics, and by understanding it so deeply by way of the three characteristics, one eliminates all the defilements, all craving, all ignorance. And so when the Buddha says, why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, what the Buddha is saying in effect is that the underlying condition for all of these deluded ways of thinking is ignorance, the lack of true knowledge, the lack of true understanding. Okay, maybe I'll stop the explanation here. And then ask if there's any questions. Okay, Suki.
When an untaught ordinary person who has no regard.
Okay, the question is, what is meant by this expression, who has no regard for noble ones? The actual Pali Ariyanang Adasavi means literally who is not a seer of noble ones. I think it could be understood to mean, could be understood in two ways. At one level, it could be understood to mean one who does not go to see the noble ones, one who does not have any kind of curiosity or interest to go seeking out noble ones in order to visit them, to seek out instruction from them. You see, it's related to the Pali word dasana, which means seeing. It's like the Sanskrit word darshana, just like the contemporary Hindi word darshan. And it's still used in India that people go to see what they consider a holy person to get the darshan of that person. So even in the Buddha's time, if one hears about a saintly person, a holy person, an enlightened one, one goes to to get the darshan of that person. Though it's not with the idea that this person has some kind of mystical ability to bless one and that will make one enlightened, but it's considered to be a great opportunity just to go to see a wise, saintly, holy person. And so an uninstructed, worldly person might hear, oh, the Buddha has come to town. He's staying a couple of miles outside the town in such and such a grove together with his company of monks. And he might think, I'm too busy, I have a lot of work to do. Lots of work. I don't have time for these ascetics who just go around begging from town to town, wasting their time, wasting our time. Why don't they go get a job like the rest of us? Okay, that's one level that can be understood. No interest even in seeing that kind of person. And then the other level of meaning is who have no regard for that kind of person. No esteem, no respect, no reverence for that kind of person. I don't think it has to be taken, that it should be taken so literally.
I know that there are there's a dispute or controversy as to how to understand the no-self doctrine. And very often you hear people say, well, the Buddha didn't mean no-self completely, he meant no permanent self, no separate self. But I've read recently someone argue that it's really the Western mind which has put in the qualification of no separate self, no permanent self, and the Buddha's teaching really was no self. And so I'm wondering if the urge to qualify the no-self doctrine is a further symptom of a craving for some kind of existence.
I notice that often Westerners who are attracted to Buddhism still want to have their self and their non-self too. And sometimes some people have pointed out to me internet sites where the debates on this topic sometimes can get extremely emotional. In fact, somebody pointed out to me, or maybe I stumbled across it myself, where somebody was virtually cursing me out on the internet. That fool of a fellow Bhikkhu Bodhi in his notes to so-and-so, to such-and-such a work, thinks he knows what he's talking about, but he doesn't get it at all. But also what I say is that the Buddha's teaching of anatta is not actually saying that there's absolutely no self at all either. But I'm saying that this is not a way of slipping a self back in through the back door either. But the Buddha allows the word self and the idea of self to be used in ordinary discourse as long as it's taken to be, you know, just a word of conventional usage, convenient usage, a way of avoiding to have to use complex, cumbersome means of locution. The Buddha, in fact, there's a sutta where he says, like, after explaining a teaching with the term self, using expressions that have the word atta, atman in it, the Buddha says, these are merely worldly designations, worldly descriptions, worldly expressions that the Tathagata uses without clinging to them. In other words, he makes use of such expressions without seeing in them any kind of implication of there being some kind of permanent, substantial self. But the idea of a self is referring to what I would call the empirical personality. I would say it's quite acceptable.
And
unharmful as long as one doesn't start clinging to it and see it as implying some kind of lasting, substantial self that one could take as one's true identity. Any further questions? Was there too many Pali words here tonight?
Okay.
No.
Maybe a quick misconception. I'm not sure it's a question. When you define the, I don't know whether it was conceit or conception of being in earth, did I understand it to mean my real self is, say, the spirit existing within an earth element?
That is the.
Will become immortal at some point, the spirit, even though the earth.
Yeah, that is the way the thinkers who would be conceiving in earth would have the idea of in earth. That is the way they might formulate their idea.
Isn't that the basis of the Judeo-Christian religion then?
I'd say that is the way Christianity is often formulated. It's actually not really a Jewish belief at all. But it's... This is actually the Greek, the way Christianity has come to formulate the conception of self based upon the Greek influence. It is not a Judaic idea of selfhood at all.
I just have a comment, which is it seems to be a very concise way of teaching the Dhamma. You know, it's a compact and neat presentation of what seems like the main idea of the Buddha. Even though the reading is serious, the commentary really helps.
Maybe this is why the editors of the canon or the compilers of the canon put the sutta first, even though it's very concise and very difficult to understand, but when you explain it at length, then one can get a very rich meaning out of it. Okay, then we will end the evening session with sharing the merits to the devas, the buddhas, the nagas, asking them to rejoice in the merits, to protect the Buddha's teaching, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparam. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punyasampadang. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.